Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. Now, my next guest was on this program about a year and a half ago. We spoke to him when he had a show called The Fabulist going on, and he was working on that piece, and he's worked on a bunch of musical theater pieces, including probably his best-known Weird Romance, but he also has done a musical of The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz that we may or may not see in the future, and also some shows for family audiences. He is involved in shows called Phantom of the Opera and Les Miserables, but they're not the ones you might think they are. But anyway, he has many years of experience in writing and working on musical theater, and he's put that all together in a book about how to and how not to do the things to avoid when you are creating musical theater, both in artistic terms, when you're writing lyrics or when you're trying to compose music, what you do with a collaborator, and also dealing with producers and managers, and then everything from the very beginning, the kernel of an idea for a show, all the way to, oh my gosh, what if they really want to produce the show in a big way? Now, the book is called The Musical Theater Writer's Survival Guide, and the fella is David Spencer, and David Spencer is with us here in the neighborhood. Hello, David.
Hello.
Welcome back.
How are you?
Thank you. How you doing?
I'm good.
So, then the genesis for this book was what?
The genesis was I'm on faculty and a member of the steering committee at the BMI Musical Theater Workshop, BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop, and have been for a number of years. I actually started there way back when Lehman was still alive and teaching, and eventually I was asked to be on the committee and subsequently on the faculty.
Actually, sorry to make you detour, but why don't you give a very brief picture for our listener. Who was Lehman Engel?
Lehman Engel was known as the Dean of Broadway Musical Theater musical directors, and he conducted, I don't know how many shows, probably dozens over a career that started, I think, in the 30s. He sort of gave a symposium that BMI sponsored in the earlier mid-60s about musical theater, where some people were invited to come and listen to him talk and play stuff and get his reactions. And the event was so successful that it gradually begat a weekly meeting of writers.
Right.
And Lehman, for years and years, was the sort of one-man band who kind of ran everything as the teacher. He was sort of Papa. Actually, a guy named Alan Becker, who at the time was the head of musical theater for BMI, he was the administrative guy running things in the background. But, you know, it was Lehman's deal. And then when Lehman died, which was 1984-ish, something like that, 2 or 82 maybe, then there was kind of a bunch of flurrying and scurrying, trying to figure out how the workshop would continue, and the people who were Lehman's intimates and most prominent students at the time, who then were Maury Esten, Alan Menken, Ellen Fitzhugh, Ed Kleban, Richard Enquist, a fellow named Cary Gold, probably some others that I've left out. But they kind of hunkered down and tried to figure out how to keep the workshop going. So they decided not to have a one-man band operation, and they split up the classes among several instructors. And it took a couple of years for it to shake down into a new and actually much improved and much more effective system.
Oh, cool. And by the way, people who are interested in all this and are curious about this can also... There was a musical made about this whole workshop, a wonderful,
It's a really good musical, and it's kind of fun.
It was called The Class Act.
It was really about Ed Kleban. It was highly fictionalized in numerous aspects. One of the funniest was that it opens up with Lehman Engel at Ed's memorial at the Schubert Theater, when in fact Ed died first. And it was and Ed never had a memorial at the Schubert Theater. His memorial was at the Public. Ironically, it was Ed who used his muscle as co-author of a chorus line to make sure that Lehman would have his memorial at the Schubert Theater.
All right,
so,
well. Gosh, that is more fiction than I thought.
Well, also,
it's a lovely musical. Though,
also, the little scenes in the class, they show people being kind of very competitive, and really isn't that. In fact, it's very much a supportive community. I am co-moderator of the second year with Pat Cook and Rick Fryer, and I also moderate and put together the master classes. The regular songwriting classes, you know, people bring in individual songs and get feedback as they're working on a project. The master classes, certain projects are developed to a point where bringing in individual songs isn't as helpful anymore, and you really need to present a chunk of material, you know, so the thing can be perceived in a larger context. And so we select projects that we think are worthy or well-developed, or both.
Have there been any musicals, say, that people would know of in the last few years that went through this process?
The master classes? That's a little too soon, because those are only about 3 years old. But in terms of musicals, yeah, Avenue Q, for one thing.
And then those are the guys who did the foreword for your book.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Nice little segue there.
And Jeff Marks and Bobby Lopez. Their success was unusually meteoric. It usually doesn't happen quite that fast. But they went through the program, and, you know, they...
And it's a wonderful musical.
Really relied on the class, though, as the foreword says. And it's really interesting, you know, that they paid that much attention, and it was certainly not the only thing, by any means. They are very talented guys, but they will freely admit, and have done publicly, that the workshop was a huge help to them.
Now, I assume the workshop informed your writing of this book, of
it
course.
Did, it did. I just wanted to finish
up
the master class thing. The master class is how that works. I kind of moderate like Charlie Rose, although I talk less. And we bring in masters to essentially listen and comment. So it really is a master class, and we invite the workshop members to participate as an audience, really. And we've had Stephen Sondheim, was it the last one? The one before that was Richard Maltby and David Shire.
Sure.
We had our first master class with Sheldon Harnick and John Kander, so we really have some nice...
Yeah. Although it's a rather small field when you come to think of it. I mean, when you think of the people who
I suppose. Although I think because of our workshop, certainly... which is free, by the way. You know, just anybody who attends just attends on the basis of,
is
you know,
the audition. Five?
No, it is Mondays at 4 for the advanced. It always sort of was. That's another fiction. It was never Fridays at 5. Mondays at 4 for the advanced, 6 for the first year and the librettists, which is run by Nancy Galladay. Tuesday is around 5:30 is the second year class. Periodically, we sort of look at who's, you know, the progress of the people who are in it and make decisions about that.
Sure.
But there is no tuition. There's no fee. And it always has been free. And it's a service that's offered by BMI. But anyway, how the genesis of the book was, I didn't even realize I was writing a book at first. I also edit the BMI workshop newsletter.
Cool.
And I had been, over the course of several years, writing a bunch of articles, some in series, some one-shots. And eventually, I just kind of looked at the hard drive on my laptop, and I went, you know, I got a bunch of things here that aren't doing anything for a living. They existed for about, you know, the length of, you know, the shelf life of the newsletter article that they were written for, and then they, you know, then they went into an archive, and if people asked for them, I'd send it to them. But I thought, you know, everybody's telling me this is very useful stuff, and maybe it ought to be out there more permanently. So I assembled the articles that I had written in a pitch. I would wind up writing twice again. I had half the book ready, more or less, when I started, but I would write another half. And Jeff Sweet, who we both know, the playwright and teacher and critic, he had several years before offered to introduce me to his editor at Heinemann. And I called him up and I said, is the offer still good? He said, absolutely. He wrote an email, he introduced me, I pitched the book, and the next thing I knew, I had a contract.
And Jeff wrote the Dramatist Toolkit, which I guess is
for
playwrights, what Musical Theater Writer's Survival Guide could be for...
He wrote a sequel to that, too, and I can't remember, or maybe that was the sequel, but I know he's written two books for them.
Yeah.
And he's an excellent writer.
So let's get into the book a little bit of what you're telling people that hasn't been in other books about writing for musical theater. That were, you know, I know Lehman Engel wrote books. I know, you know, there are certainly books on the shelves about this.
Lehman
subject.
Wrote some books. I have to say that I admire a lot of what Lehman wrote in his books, but there was a degree to which he was limited in that he himself wasn't a writer. So he was sort of an insider and yet an outsider at the same time. Mm. So there are things that, to me as a writer, are perfectly obvious that he never got. Like, he went on at length in one of his books about he never understood how Man of La Mancha could have been the classic that everybody loves because he was so offended by its sentimentality. But in fact, if you put aside the sentimentality and just look at the structure, it is absolutely classic. You have the hero on a quest and the things against him, and you know, and it just follows all the classic steps and it has all the classic ingredients. So, and what this book does is it looks, for example, in terms of the art of it, it looks at what are the classic ingredients of successful musicals. And by successful, I don't necessarily or just mean they made a lot of money and everybody got rich. I mean they stayed in the literature. I mean they get done everywhere. They get, you know, they get produced everywhere. Their professional life ends and then they're in stock and amateur forever. So it's a look at that. And what's interesting, indeed fascinating, is that about, conservatively, I'd say 90% of all successful musicals follow a, I hesitate to call it a template because you don't want to talk about cookie cutterness with musicals because they can be as wide ranging as anything else, but they do follow, they do have certain ingredients, and I think the ingredients happen because it's such an elevated art form. And I've not known that to be codified before in print, broken down into, you know, really understanding what the elements are.
Well, let's. Why don't you pick, say, a particular?
Have that for a second.
I'm actually holding the book, The Musical Theater Writer's Survival Guide.
And I'm actually putting on my glasses now so I can read my own prose.
But what I'd love to know is, I mean, there are shows that are perfectly watchable and whatever, and they just don't sort of happen. And then there are others that, as you say, are classics. I'd love to be able to define how one show really hits all the, and becomes special. And then you have, say, a Frank Wildhorn show that seems to, that has a plot, that has songs, that tries to follow A, B, and C, and yet the critics don't like it, the audiences don't come, and it may vanish forever.
Well, I sort of don't want to talk about, at least in this context, of a specific writer and say, well, this is why the guy failed.
Or a specific show.
Well,
you can pick a show by the same writers of a classic. Let's say if you wanted to go with
a
Jerry Herman plot.
And indeed, those are the shows where they did not follow. Well, I won't say follow, because, you know, they're experimenting and things aren't codified. Who makes up the rules? These are not really rules, but they are principles distilled from decades and decades and decades of musicals that exist and prove the point. But indeed, when you look at the musicals of established writers that, you know, go off the rails or don't have a commercial success as much as we love them, they are in fact the musicals that don't follow the principles of what is traditionally commercially successful.
Okay.
And, for example, much as I love Pacific Overtures, it is one of my favorite musicals in the world, by the way. It's this big panorama thing. It doesn't really follow one character all the way through.
I agree. It's sort of about work, ultimately.
Right. And then you have something like Sweeney Todd, Gypsy, you know, with the driven hero who needs to accomplish something, and the whole show is motored by that. And those are the shows, in fact. A funny thing happened on the way to the forum, all about Pseudolus's quest for freedom.
Right.
So all of those shows that fall into that category in the Sondheim catalog, those are the ones that are the big commercial successes for him.
Yeah, but he is such an experimenter. You know, Sondheim is not fair because he'll take the... I mean, if you look at Sunday in the Park with George, you know, the first act
is one of
the greatest things ever, but
and by the way, nobody says that those musicals weren't necessary. In fact, I don't think there's probably not a Sondheim musical that we're not all the better for and haven't somehow been able to draw something from stylistically, like Company or Follies, or I remember reading a very convincing essay by I can't remember his name, Martin Gottfried, who said that he thought that Pacific Overtures was even more pervasive an influence on the musical theater than A Chorus Line, and in fact, well, they were in the same season, so they probably didn't cross-pollinate, but I mean, I think he's right. I certainly don't mean to cast those musicals in any kind of a diminished light. What I am saying, though, is that for a writer who is not established, who is looking to get a show on, get it produced, have it have some kind of longevity, have it be attractive to producers, critics, audiences, to have the best possible shot at that, then I think the more you have, for example, the hero who's on a quest, who drives the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Let me get to the others here.
But then again, lots of flop shows have had that.
Well, they have that, but there are other things, too. You also have to be character-driven as opposed to plot-driven.
Okay.
You also need to have supporting characters that are not only interesting but functional. In other words, if they're there for a reason.
Okay.
You also need not to drop the plot tension. There are musicals where the hero goes away, and then other things happen, and you just lose whatever is driving the show.
That happens.
Somebody very smart once said, when your main character leaves the stage, the other characters better be worried about him.
Hmm. That's very good.
You want conflict subsequently that kicks in early and doesn't resolve until the end.
Okay.
You also have to set up what are called your permissions. In other words, permission to be funny, permission to be dramatic, permission to do whatever, permission to follow a dramatic theme, just so you have a lens by which the audience perceives everything. This is really important because, for example, in a straight play, you can take a while to introduce where you're going, because people come on, they talk in dialogue, even if it's stylized, it's some kind of emulation of real time. But a musical is compressed.
Uh-huh.
And in compression, there's a kind of speed. And in that speed comes a heightened kind of storytelling, and so the audience expectations are sped up subsequently. And so you have to be very, very clear right at the top what you're doing, what you're going to explore for the evening, because that's what the audience is prepared to follow. And if that is not clear, as so many of the musicals you're talking about that are watchable but they just don't happen, I would say 50% of the time or more, it's because the permissions aren't set up properly, and so you don't know exactly what ride you're on. For example, one of the most famous stories, which I'm sure you know and have probably even referred to, is what happened out of town with Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, when they talked about, they opened up with this lilting little melody called Love is in the Air. The audience was baffled. And then Jerome Robbins came in and said, well, you have to give the audience permission to laugh. Subsequently, Comedy Tonight.
Right. They popped that song, and suddenly it was this, they were laughing immediately, and boom.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most classic and simple example, but there are others that are more complex. But it's still about setting up the path so that the audience doesn't have to figure out. For example, I can think of a musical I won't name right now, but it's a musical I admire a great deal. But you don't know at the top exactly who your hero is. And so you spend like the first half hour just kind of getting a panorama of characters, and then you go, oh, that's whose story it is. Now I know what ride I'm on, but I'm too late.
Well, that could be Oklahoma, actually, but yeah.
So those are the things that the book goes into. The book also goes into what you need to keep in mind when you are collaborating. The principles and steps for keeping a collaboration healthy. The importance of, I mean, it sounds very simple, but it's amazing the kind of things that can flummox open communication, because we're doing something that's so personal, and because we feel exposed, and because, you know, you can feel threatened, and there's all kinds of pressures that come on you, and you don't quite know how to balance them, and you could find yourself doing something to threaten a collaboration without even meaning to. Don't set up a meeting, you know, that's going to be about the fate of your show somewhere without discussing it with your collaborators. Don't give out a CD without discussing, you know. I mean, I actually know of an example where this happened, where somebody had arranged a reading primarily for the benefit of producer X, and his collaborator decided to invite producer Y along too.
And that was just...
Well, producer X didn't expect anybody else to be there.
Ouch.
You know, so that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I also talk about how you try to find the best possible director for your show. It's so important to really, really, really listen to what they say at the first meeting, because generally the director who will not ultimately work for you. We'll give you a clue right at the top. And it's not because he's a bad guy or a bad woman or insincere or anything like that, but other than acting, directing is perhaps the most instinctive and impulsive of the theatrical arts, because no matter how much preparation the director does before he walks into the rehearsal room, he also has to react to all those elements, you know, spontaneously as he's sort of traffic managing and combining and all of that. And so at your meeting, too, when he's reacting to you, that's a fairly accurate barometer of the directorial instincts at play. And it's about how to listen to that. It's also about when you're not sure what to do to get more information, which is research as productions. They're on, you know, if they are on tape at Lincoln Center, you get to watch them, you know, and a production will tell you a lot more than any meeting, you know, if, you know, what kind of a touch you're looking for. But it's generally about gathering the resources that are available, understanding how to read signals that you might not know how to understand if you haven't been burned a couple of times, you know. And I've really never seen that kind of thing talked about before. And I was, you know, when I was looking for the celeb quotes for the cover, you know, I gave it to, among others, I gave it to Richard Maltby, and what I got back almost made me cry, because it was exactly, you know, the kind of response I would have wanted a professional to give, which was, I've never seen anything like this before.
This
is going to save you all kinds of...
Well, speaking of the writing of the thing, you also have a chapter in there of, like, rules for writing the book of a musical.
Well, I went into some of that just now. Those are the principles of libretto.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I say, that's kind of covered. We talked about that, but there's also I do go into the elements of music and lyrics.
Right.
That
the AABA thing, literally down to the syllable.
Down to the syllable. I also talk about certain concepts that I think are actually more complicated than we sometimes think they are. For example, there is a general rule, that self-pitying songs don't really work unless they're comedic, or unless the self-pity is somehow earned because we've been long enough with the character on the journey. But I actually looked at that a little further, and virtually all the songs I found that were self-pitying that we tolerate as audiences, they're actually not as self-pitying as all that. They seem like, on the surface, a character is feeling sorry for himself or herself. But if you actually examine the dramatic moment, that self-pity is either a weapon or it's a motivator. For example, if you look at Aldonza in Man of La Mancha, when she's giving him all her backstory about she was born on a dung heap to die on a dung heap, and, you know, so why do I not think that she's just beating her breast and being a pain in the butt? It's because what she's really trying to do is to get a rise out of Quixote. And the more he stands implacable, the more she tries to shatter him, you know? And so it's and what's going on is, in fact, not a self-pity wail, it's a very active contest of wills. She is trying so hard to shock him, and he's unshockable. And that's what gets her angrier and angrier, and that's why the moment is so good. It's the same thing with, for example, if you look at Little Women in Annie, which is, of course, funny. But it's
not the musical Little Women,
I say Little Women, I meant Little Girls.
Okay.
Little Girls. Little Girls, right. It really isn't just... this is who I am and I'm feeling sorry for myself, you know, because of where it's placed and because of how she sings it, that this is her motivator, that she's feeling overwhelmed and she wants out. That's what the song is telling you. So, in fact, it's active.
Well, it's like Adelaide in Guys and Dolls. A person can develop a cold. I mean, you can say, oh, you know, all these things he's doing to me.
But it's active.
It's
very, very active because it's pointing forward. Yeah. An oft-taught and very true principle that ideally, well, really, always, a song can only be about one thing. However, that gets tricky, too, because the more sophisticated the songwriter, the more sophisticated the application. For example, you look at God That's Good in Sweeney Todd. There are so many things going on, but they all feed into the central plot point, which is the career advancement of Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett. You know, they're just different points of view on it.
Right.
And how Sondheim accomplishes that is fascinating, but it's still a big song about one thing.
Can we hear an example of one of your songs that kind of demonstrates one of your points?
I'll tell a story on myself, actually. When we were doing the very musical that you talked about, The Fabulous, the opening number at the time, that was our second reading, It was a number called They're Only Human. This is the musical is an epic fable about Aesop. And there's a Greek chorus of animals who are animals from his fables. And this song, essentially, they were singing about the foibles of humanity, because they're looking at the what is supposed to be the impending execution of Aesop, who and they want to try and rescue him, and how can humanity kill him because he was such a good guy and he was so wise and he taught them so much. And it set up a musical about the foibles of humanity and learning to accept your own flawed humanity. And yet there were very important plot points that just were not landing with the audience. Among them was the importance of the god Apollo as the antagonist, who is really never seen in the show. He's just this presence that people talk about. That never landed. Another thing that never quite landed was a very important plot point that has to do with the end of the show, which is that Aesop finally gets pissed off enough to not tell a fable. Fables have protected him because it allows him to tell the truth without pointing fingers and naming names.
Yeah.
But he finally gets so angry that he tells the truth flat out without any kind of embellishment, and subsequently is framed and arrested and,
right,
you know, sentenced to death. And I debated this with my collaborator, Stephen Witkin, because it's also the end of the novel by John Bornholt. And something about it felt like kind of a throwaway. It never quite landed for me, even when I read the source material. But Stephen was insistent, and I think correctly, that we not change it. But I didn't know what to do about it. And in the aftermath of that second reading, I was thinking about it. I said, you know, if that's such an important point, and we're heading toward it, I have to be working backwards from that. Everything in the show has to point to that.
Ah.
So I kind of did a backwards tracking, and I said, oh my God, it's the wrong opening number. And if it's the wrong opening number, it's the wrong dramatic theme. And I called Stephen, and I said, you know what? This is not a show about learning to accept your own flawed humanity. This is a show about the truth, how you tell it, to whom, to what consequence, you know, what happens if you forget to do it tactfully.
Yeah.
And once I understood that, then I understood about setting up other things like the god Apollo. And so all of that stuff was front-loaded in the new opening number, which I have for you, and you will see how it's and it completely changed. When we did a third reading, it completely changed how the audience perceived everything. And it solved a bunch of other problems in the show as well.
Well, cool. We're going to hear, to end the segment, that opening number from The Fabulous. Well, what is the song actually called?
The new song is called You Can Always Find a Fable.
You Can Always Find a Fable. And you can find not only a fable, but several fables and lots of really good and constructive and practical advice in The Musical Theater Writer's Survival Guide, written by David Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R, if you're looking for it. As I said, it has a foreword by Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks, who co-created Avenue Q. It's from Heinemann Books and available all the usual book places.
Should be.
Good.
I'm willing.
Yeah, and also online and stuff. I mean, do you have a website of your own? Or
There is a website. I have my drama critic website, which is www.ilsay.com. That's spelled AISLESAY.com. There's a page for the book off of ILSAY. So you go to ILSAY.com and then type in NY-guide, GUIDE, capital letters, dot HTML, small letters. Actually, you know what? You don't even have to listen to all this. If you go to ILSA.com, there are links to the pages.
Sounds good.
And you'll find it.
So let's get fabling, thanks to David Spencer.
Thank you.